the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and it's your favorite time of year. You know that. And no, I'm not talking about Christmas or Hanukkah or any other festival where somebody gives you presents. I'm talking about where you have to cough up something. It's tax time. And you know what? It's time to focus on taxes and how they affect retirement. So we're going to entitle this particular program, Taxes, Why They Suck and How You Can Minimize Their Impact. Next to shelter, you know, and to your medical expenses in retirement. Of course, food tends to be one too. But taxes are probably the largest expense you're going to experience in retirement following what you pay to house yourself and for your medical expenses. And what many people are experiencing is that as you age, taxes are going up. It's a very strange phenomenon. You think it would go elsewhere. Well, first of all, it's going up because taxes are going up, and I'm not sure whether or not that's going to change at any time in the near future. Social Security, if you're drawing on that, that affects your tax status. And there are also required minimum distributions from pension plans, which once again affect the amount of taxes that you are paying. So since it is tax season, and since we talk about retirement here on the program, let's talk about them both together.
Well, I guess, John, we're going to probably start out with some good news. If you're retired, there is one tax that you get rid of, assuming you're retired and you're no longer working, and that's the Social Security tax. That's 7.65%. If you are working as an employee for a company, if you're self-employed, it's 15.3%. And then once you reach the Social Security limits, which are about $128,000 for 2017, you pay an additional 1.45% if you're an employee on any income that exceeds that, and 2.9% if you're self-employed. Then if you're fortunate enough to make a certain level of income, 200 single, 250,000. If you are married, you pay an additional 0.9% in Social Security tax. So the good news, John, is if you are retired and no longer working, you do get rid of the Social Security tax, a 7.65. So for a lot of people, you know what? Close to 7% tax or 15% if you're self-employed, that's another tax rate that you can get rid of. It's almost like getting rid of your state income tax.
Well, we hear a lot of talk about reforming the tax code to simplify it, because what's happened is every time we simplify it, then the Congress critters can't resist it and they begin making changes to it year after year. And finally, you wind up in a situation where they've done experiments like this, Jim. If you give the, say, an average tax return, not super simple, not super complex, but, you know, maybe somebody who's got a lot of investments and things of that nature and income, and they give it to 50 different CPAs or tax attorneys, and they pay them, just like a client would, to fill out these returns. And guess what? None of them ever gets the same result. So if this is so simple, you know, that we're supposed to determine what the tax is, why is that? And so then they talk about simplifying it, and they do occasionally. We did a lot of simplifying under the Reagan administration, but guess what? Over time, they just can't resist monkeying with it, and they begin building in all sorts of changes. And right now we're facing, well, you've got regular tax rates, then you've got a deduction phase out. Okay, so we all have deductions, but then when you get over a certain point, they figure you shouldn't take those deductions. And there are exemptions that are phased out for certain things. Something has begun creeping down into the middle class. That's the alternative minimum tax. And remember, that was a tax that was introduced for people who were able to completely zero out their taxes. If they were over a certain gross income, they would still have to pay some tax. Well, due to inflation now, more and more people have been drifting up into the AMT category, so that sort of catches people unawares. There are different capital gains taxes, dividends taxes, Medicare taxes, and don't forget the Obamacare taxes. And we're not sure where even that is going at this stage of the game. So it's really hard to plan for a lot of this stuff because it's so blasted complex.
Well, let's see if we can make this a little bit simpler for our listeners. You know, we talk about a number. You know, what's the number that you should try to achieve where it allows you to retire and live off the income? One number that you need to know, whether you're working or you are going to be retired, and you need to know what the number is going to be. Let's say if you're working, if you plan on retiring, what that number is going to be, and that's your tax bracket. Now, let me just go through these real quickly because some of these are going to be really important in terms of giving you some kind of control in terms of the taxes you pay. For most people, I'm going to start out with individual taxpayers. If you're under 9,300, you're in a zero bracket or a 10% bracket. From 9,000 to about 38,000, you're in a 15% bracket. 38,000 to 92,000, you're in a 25% bracket. 92,000 to 192, you're in a 28% bracket. Above 192 to 416, you're 33. And from 416 to 418, you're 35. They don't give you much leeway there. Anything over 418, you're in a 39.6. Now, you might think about, okay, it stops there. It really doesn't. But let me get to married taxpayers. It's a little bit better. 19,000 and under, you're 10%. 19,000 to 76,000, you're 15. 76,000 to 153, and I'm rounding off these numbers to get through them quickly, you're in a 25% bracket. 153 to 233, you're in a 28% bracket. Most individuals, I find, John, are in either a 28 or 33%. If you're more fortunate than that, you go into that 33% bracket all the way to 39.6. The higher brackets for married couples start at 233,000 to 416. That's a 33% bracket. And from 416 to 470, it's a little better for a married couple. You're in a 35% bracket. Here's something that really catches single people. From 416 to 418, you actually go up 2 percentage points. In other words, you make $2,000 more, your tax bracket goes up another 2%. So that's something that can easily, you know, if you're doing a little tax planning, you can get rid of that. Head of household, it gets a little better. So these are the numbers you need to know. And the important thing about this is that's the number that tells you that if you get $1 more of income, let's say you're at the end of the year, you get a bonus, or for example, you get a cost of living increase or some kind of raise or promotion, that is what that dollar of extra income is going to be taxed at. So you need to know that number. It fits in well with what you're investing in. Now, if it was all that easy, it would be very simple. You just know what your tax bracket is, and you could plan from that. But guess what? It isn't that easy. There are a number of things that they do. They start phasing out your itemized deductions, and this is called the Pease Amendment. And pay close attention to what I'm talking about here, because when you're going to do your tax planning, this all gets around the bottom of your front page of your tax return on your 1040. At the very bottom of the page, it says adjusted gross income. And why that's important is the phase out of your itemized deductions, the phase out of your exemptions, the increase in your Obamacare taxes and your capital gains taxes all center around what that number is. Now, if you are a single individual and you make over $261,500, what they do, and let's just round this out, and let's just say that you make $300,000. I'm doing this for illustration. They take 3% of your adjusted gross income, the number on the bottom of the front page of your tax return. So in this case, if you made $300,000, they would take 3% of that, which would be $9,000, and they subtract that on the backside of your tax return from your itemized deductions. So you begin losing your itemized deductions at $261,500 if you're single. And if you are married, that begins to phase out at $313,800. And if you are head of household, $287,650. Then they take those same numbers and they begin to phase out your exemptions. If you are an individual, your exemption is $4,050. So if you're married, $4,050 for you, $4,050 for your wife, and $4,050 for each one of your kids. They begin to phase them out at $261,500 individual, married $313,800, and head of household at $287,000. So you can see that not only do you have your regular marginal income tax bracket, you have a number where you start losing your itemized deductions, which increases your income tax by another full percentage point. You have another number that also phases out your personal exemptions. And then you have a number in which they hit you with what we call the Obamacare taxes. And that number is $200,000 if you're single, and it's $250,000 if you were married. Once you exceed that level, they add an additional 0.9% to your Medicare tax that you pay on any income above your Social Security limit. At that level, your capital gains, taxes on your dividends, and taxes on your interest also go up. For example, at that level, your capital gains tax goes from 15% to as high as 23.8%. Taxes on your dividends go from 15% to 23.8%. And if you have taxable interest income, your top tax bracket with the Obamacare taxes on top of that could go to 43.4%. Another way of looking at that is, let's say you earn $1,000 of interest, your highest tax rate on that interest can go up to almost 44%. So these are numbers, John, that you really need to understand, because there's three or four different levels of income that you earn. They begin subtracting. You begin losing your itemized deductions. You begin losing your exemptions. You begin paying higher taxes on your investments. You begin paying higher Medicare taxes. So you really have to juggle this, and it takes a lot of strategic planning, especially if you're working, or let's say you're Larry Lots of Bucks and you're in those higher tax brackets.
All right, Jim, what we need to do, I guess, is talk about the Republican plan, because that's the one that they are talking about right now, both Mr. Trump and the Republicans, although we don't know quite what their plans are. They seem to be working on either reforming or repealing and passing new healthcare legislation right now. Had Mrs. Clinton won, based on what she was saying, we would have seen substantially higher regular income taxes and capital gains taxes. Also, by the way, estate taxes, which we call the death tax. Okay, but let's assume that President Trump and the Republicans are going to get their tax plan through. Do we have any inkling of what it's going to look like?
Well, the agreement between the president and the Republican Congress, the seven tax rates that we have now from 39.6 all the way down to 10 would be modified, and we would have three tax rates, a 12% tax rate, a 25% tax rate, and a 33% tax rate. And those levels would be at lower levels of income. The corporate tax rate, which is 35%, the highest in the world, would go down to 20. And the tax on interest and dividends, there's three different rates depending on who you're talking to. There's the Republican plan, where you could see capital gains taxes and taxes on interest drop to 6%, 12.5%, and 16.5%. The estate tax would be repealed. Right now, it's 40% on anything over $5,450,000, or actually $490,000 for 2017. So the good news is they're proposing lowering those taxes both for corporations. This would include sub-S corporations, C corporations, and then also individuals. So the good news, John, is they're talking about lowering taxes, and it's probably one of the fastest ways they could stimulate the economy versus infrastructure, which may take 3 to 4 years to actually play out.
Yeah, the trend, however, overall, if you look over the years, if you maybe we benchmark where we reset things during the Reagan administration when he got both parties in Congress to work on some real tax reform, it's always been towards higher taxes, no matter what the discussion is. And the pendulum tends to swing back and forth. If the Democrats are in control, then the taxes swing higher. If the Republicans are in control, it tends to swing back lower, but I don't think it ever goes back to where it benchmarked at the start.
No, the lowest tax rates that we saw were really under Ronald Reagan. It was the 28% tax rate. In exchange for that, they phased that lower rate in over a three-year period. We had it 1 year, and we lost deductions, for example, on sales tax. We lost deductions on real estate. We lost a lot of the tax shelter deductions in exchange for lower rate. That lasted 1 year. The following year, George H. Bush, remember, read my lips, no new taxes, he raised the tax rates to 31%. Then Bill Clinton raised them to 39.6. They added the Pease Amendment, which phased out part of your itemized deductions. Then, of course, with Obama, we got the Obamacare taxes. So the trend has been towards higher taxes.
Okay, so given this trend then, Jim, the real question I think most of us ask is how can we legally reduce, this is called avoid, which is legal, as opposed to evade, which is illegal. How do you reduce taxes in this environment? And it seems to be an ongoing thing. You have to keep monitoring this. You just can't do a plan and say, okay, we're fixed because next year they're going to do something different.
Well, they changed the rules, and they've done that with every administration, depending once again. Democrats come in, they raise taxes. Republicans come in, they lower taxes. And there's only basically four ways that you're going to reduce your taxes. And one is tax-free. We'll talk about different methods for that. Two is tax-deferred. Three is tax-sheltered. And four is tax-preferred. Now, what's really important here in if you're doing tax planning, and this is also a trend as well, there's what we call deductions above the line and deductions below the line. And all that means is deductions above the line are what is on the front page of your tax return. The second page, deductions below the line, are really itemized deductions. And the kind of things that you would see, and this really hits in the investment area, in the pension area, if you take a look at things that reduce your taxable income. And the reason you want to reduce, most of your tax planning should focus on deductions above the line, because by reducing your adjusted gross income, you also make it possible to not get caught up in losing your itemized deductions, the phase out of your exemptions, or the Obamacare taxes. And things that can reduce your income. Well, one is tax-exempt income. If you have income that comes from tax-free bonds or a Roth IRA, that is not subject to income tax. That's a way to reduce income. If you have dividends that come in from a mutual fund or dividends that come in from a stock, they're taxed at a 15% rate or as high as 23.8, depending on your income, versus your tax brackets of 28-33%, going all the way to 39. There's also things like capital gains. Capital gains are taxed at a lower bracket. There's also things, for example, if you have rental income, maybe you have rental properties where you can shelter part of your income from real estate. So royalties, partnerships, subchapter S corporations are taxed at lower income. So then you also have something called tax preferred, which are tax deferred. And those are things like, for example, if you are at work, you put money in a 401k program, that reduces your taxable income. If you are contributing to a self-employed SEP or an IRA or a health savings account, that reduces your taxable income. So the whole idea of what you want to do is to reduce as much as you can and get the income at the bottom of your front page of your tax return, your adjusted gross income. You want to get that as low as you can, because all those other things we talked about, all the additional taxes, the phase out of your exemptions and your deductions and the Obamacare taxes all kick in on that number on the bottom of the front page of your tax return. And given where we are going with tax history, you've seen it under Clinton, and you saw it also under Obama, and they're phasing out itemized deductions. And by the way, one of the things that comes in with the Trump plan and also with the Republican plan for upper income individuals, you will trade a 39.6% tax bracket for a 33, so you'll save 6.5%, but then they're going to turn around and start to phase out your itemized deductions. In other words, they'll cap them at around $100,000. So you're not free and clear and thinking, oh, great, boy, I'd rather pay 33% than 39.6. But you may end up losing some of your itemized deductions. So that's why these deductions above the line are so important, because these are things that you can have some control, especially, for example, if you take a look at the taxability of your investments or the timing of taking capital gains. Those are things that you have some control over.
Okay, let's go through some examples of things that people can actually do so it marks it in their minds.
The obvious one, if you're in a high tax bracket, if you're in a 39.6, you add 1% for losing your itemized deductions. The Obamacare tax at 3.8, you add phasing out your personal exemptions, and all of a sudden you're in a 43.6% bracket. You add your state taxes like California, which can go up to 13.3, all of a sudden you're at 57%. So, you know, it might make some sense for tax-free bonds. Another thing a lot of you should be considering, every one of you that is working in contributing should consider a Roth IRA, because anything that comes out of a Roth IRA, let's say you buy a dividend stock that pays 5% or 4%, it comes out of a Roth, if you've held it 5 years, it's tax-free. And you don't have required minimum distribution. So tax-free, either munis or a Roth IRA. Tax-sheltered. And this can come in the form of real estate. You own real estate, you have a rental property, or you have master limited partnerships. These are partnerships that trade on the stock exchange, where a good majority, sometimes 60, 70% of the income, is sheltered against taxes. Tax preferred. I'm always amazed at sometimes you see individuals will buy or invest in taxable interest, and you know they have their money at the bank, they're getting 1% at the bank versus, let's say, 3 or 4% in stock dividends, and they're paying a higher tax rate on their interest than they do in dividends. So dividend paying stocks or dividend paying mutual funds is another way that you can reduce your taxable income, because it's sheltered, either real estate or MLPs, and then dividends, which are taxed at 15%, a little higher if you're in those upper income brackets. The other thing you can do are things called health savings account, which is, by the way, being promoted here in the Republican American healthcare bill that's working its way through the House right now. They are pushing health savings accounts, where you would put money in a health savings account. You can deduct it on above the line on the front page of your tax return. And then later on, when you use that income to pay for medical expenses, as we talk so often here on the program, that is tax free. So health savings accounts is another one. And then the last one we're going to talk about is tax deferred. And these simply, if you're at work and you're contributing to 401k plan, a 457, if you're at the government, or 403b plan, if you're a teacher, that money goes directly into the pension plan and is not included in taxable income.
So what you're saying here then is that the first emphasis, at least here, because it comes before everything, is to lower your adjusted gross income, is what it's called, in order to avoid losing deductions and the phase out of exemptions and some of the other taxes that, let's say, for example, Obamacare have piled onto things.
Absolutely. And if you do not itemize, let me just give you an example. The standard deduction is $6,350 for a single individual, $12,700 for a married person, and an exemption is $4,050. So what that amounts to, that's $10,400 if you're single, almost $21,000 if you're married. I mean, that is a good amount of deductions, even if you don't itemize. I mean, think of a family, let's say a husband and wife that has two children. John, you're talking about almost $16,200 in exemptions. And then whatever itemized deductions, maybe they have a mortgage, they give to charity, they pay state taxes, these items can get very hefty.
Okay, those are the deductions, what we call above the line. And I think we're usually talking, like on the long form 1040, we're talking about line 37. Let's talk about things that are below the line, meaning after you have your adjusted gross income, what can you subtract from that?
Well, these are the things, medical expenses, but once again, They're limiting what you can take in itemized deductions. Once again, I want to point a trend that we've seen started since Bill Clinton, and that has been the removal of itemized deductions. You can deduct medical expenses, but only if they exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. Once again, there's that number, adjusted gross income. Then there's taxes that you pay for, state taxes, property taxes, personal taxes. Then there's mortgage interest. There's charity deductions, job expenses, casualty losses if they exceed a certain amount of your income, and miscellaneous deductions if they exceed a certain amount of your adjusted gross income. So even if you get to deductions below the line, so many of those deductions are dependent on your adjusted gross income. There's really two items you need to focus on. You need to focus on your total marginal tax bracket, because that's telling you what you're paying taxes on your investments. It's going to tell you what you're going to pay taxes on if you get a raise, a cost of living, a promotion, a bonus. And then the other figure you need to focus on is what is your adjusted gross income? And you need to try to reduce that as much as you can so that you don't lose out on those itemized deductions and you don't get hit with the Obama taxes or the phase out.
Okay, so those are the items that we've talked about. How do you apply this in terms of very effective strategies in order to be able to reduce the taxation overall, both above and below the line?
I'm going to aim this more towards somebody that's retired or maybe nearing retirement. One of the things you might want to consider is when you retire, let's say you're not in that high tax bracket. So you need to know what your tax bracket's going to be when you retire. That's one of the things that we always do when we do a financial plan, John. When somebody's getting ready to retire, we all take a look at, okay, where are your sources of income, your pension, your Social Security, and then we compute, all right, this is what your tax bracket is going to be when you retire, so that we can start using things like Roth conversions, where we might want to convert part of your IRA into a Roth conversion and have that taxed at a lower tax bracket. So now what you have is a source of tax-free income. Why that's going to be important? We have found in planning with a lot of our clients, when they get to age 70 and a half, when you have to take required mandatory distributions every single year, and those distributions go up each year, it's pushing people into higher tax brackets. So we'll use Roth conversions when we're putting together a tax plan to reduce taxes, not only now when you're in a lower bracket, but later on when you can be going back into a higher bracket as a result of distributions from your pension plan. We also take a look at, for example, when an individual has to start taking, let's say, distributions at age 70 and a half, we may start to convert part of their personal portfolio into tax-free or tax-favored investments, so that, let's say, if you're going to have to take, I don't know, let's just make this easy, and let's say you're going to have to take $5,000 of additional income out of your IRA beginning at age 70 and a half, we might look over on the taxable side and reduce your taxable income by $5,000 by converting to tax-free, tax-favored, so that you're not moving into a higher tax bracket. The other thing that we might do is we might use strategies in putting together, especially individuals that have deferred compensation. We may have you draw down that deferred compensation over a period of time, delay taking your Social Security so it's going up 8% a year, and we might start converting a good portfolio into tax-free bonds. I had an individual that retired from an oil company, and he had a deferred comp program, he had a pension, and he also had personal investments. And so what we did is we took his payout from his company and his deferred comp program, paid out to him over a 10-year period. So to minimize the higher tax bracket on that, we converted part of his pension into a Roth IRA. So we now had a big source of tax-free income. And we also converted part of his personal investment portfolio into tax-free bonds. So on his personal side, in his plan, we only used tax-free bonds, a Roth, which gave him tax-free income, in only dividend-paying stocks, which were only taxed at 15%. And we also reduced the impact of his required distributions at age 70 through the Roth conversions. And so, you know, one of the three tools you better become acquainted with if you are planning. I mean, we look at this in every single plan that we put together for somebody retiring, is we look at tax-free, tax-sheltered, and tax preference as a way of controlling income, because it's not just when you retire, it's right after you retire and after age 70 and a half. So there are a lot of key dates here that come into play. Age 62, when you can first get Social Security. Age 66, when you're eligible for full Social Security benefits. And age 70 and a half, when you have to take required distributions.
And what you're pointing out here is, while we reviewed various individual items, what you're trying to do is to use individual strategies multiply. In other words, what seems to work in combination both before and after retirement. And those strategies may shift as you retire, but you're still using the same process.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's one kind of strategy we may use ahead of retirement. We may use a second strategy the day you retire. And then we'll be using another strategy in your plan when you turn 70 and a half. The whole idea is to keep your taxes down to a minimum because, I mean, let's face it this way. If you can lower your taxes, that's another major expense that you are reducing. And that's going to become more important as you age, as you get older, because your medical expenses are going to be going up. So if you can reduce your income taxes, it's one way to pay for them. It's something that all retirees find themselves in, is a dilemma at age 70 and a half. And especially now, with most retirees living into their 80s, you can imagine what your IRA distributions are going to be when you turn 85 or age 90. I've got quite a few 90-year-olds as clients, and we've been phasing either Roth conversions, dividend-paying stocks, or tax-free investments we've been doing over a number of years to change and keep them in a minimum tax bracket. And you have to remember too, folks, when you start receiving Social Security, a good portion of that Social Security is going to become taxable. 50% of it's going to be taxable if you're single making $25,000 a year. 85% of it will be taxable if you're making $34,000 and single. If you're married, 50% of your Social Security is taxable on $32,000, and 85% of your Social Security becomes taxable if you make $44,000. So you really want to minimize your investments, and you also want to do some key strategies with your pension, your IRA rollovers, deferred compensation. All these things need to be put together in a cohesive plan so you don't get caught in a permanent tax trap. And be wary, folks, of what I call year-end surprises. For a lot of you that are investing, rolling over your money, or investing in mutual funds are required on any capital gains, short or long-term, or dividends, to declare those at the end of the year. And what happens, let's say your mutual fund goes from $10 to $12. In that $12, two of it is capital gains. At the end of the year, they declare $2 in capital gains. You pay taxes on the $2 in capital gains, but the shares drop from $12 down to $10. There's some strategies to use with mutual funds to minimize what I call the gotcha surprise that normally comes in the fourth quarter of the year that catches a lot of people by surprise and pops them into higher tax brackets.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, Gary Taubes is going to be with us. We talk about the issue of course, many times here on the program, longevity and things you can do to improve your health. He has a thing called the case against sugar. Too much sugar as an intake into your food is a bad thing. It causes inflammation and other things. So Americans should be reducing the sugar, and there's sugar in virtually everything, unless you're very picky about what you eat. Now it's time for our case study, which we do weekly here on the program, based on the lives of real people whose names have been changed to protect their privacy, but they do exemplify a lot of the principles which we're discussing right here on Lifetime Income. And don't forget, we have slides on the website at financialsense.com that illustrate the principles being discussed here. All right, Jim, case study for this week.
This is Lucas and Anna Mueller. Lucas and Ann are both age 47. Both want to retire at age 65. We told them basically they might want to consider age 67 because of full Social Security benefits. But right now, the plan to have them retire at 65. Based on their longevity and health questionnaire, Lucas' life expectancy is age 88, and Ann is age 92. Their risk tolerance, moderately aggressive. Lucas, 47. He's a software engineer. He's been working for the same company since college. Up to this point, he's managed all of his own investments, but is becoming increasingly concerned about market conditions, and especially with the Fed on a rate raising cycle. Wanted some professional help. He's sort of been in the past, I would characterize him as aggressive buy and hold investor who has large exposure to small cap funds, emerging markets, and he's concerned about taxes. He recently got promoted. His salary increased, which put both him and his wife into a higher tax bracket. Anna, age 47, she's a school psychologist. She's looking to help for managing their finances, and especially college planning. Since they had two kids in high school, they're going to be entering college. Now, when we took a look at their budget, we basically said, look, you've got enough money, you can pay for an in-state school tuition, and especially if they live at home. Those are the things that you can cover. But if your kids want to go outside the state to a university, plus room and board, if they do want to live at home or even a private education, that was something that was agreed upon between Lucas and Anna and their two children, that look, hey, this is what we put aside, this is what we can afford. And a lot of that came from funds that were set aside in a 529 plan from both Anna and Luke's parents, who put some money aside, and that money was invested in a plan. So they had money to cover a basic education if the kids lived at home, which meant a local university. Outside of that, basically, if they went outside of San Diego, if they went up to Los Angeles or up to San Francisco or Sacramento or wherever, the kids were going to have to get a job or get a loan to pay for room and board, because there's just no way that they could achieve their retirement goals plus education. What was really surprising, and we have a very sophisticated program that assesses risk, and if you look at a score of 1 being absolutely risk adverse, 10 to being very aggressive, Lucas and Anna, their risk score was a 4. And I took a look at their portfolio. I said, but your portfolio has a risk of 7. So there was a misalignment in terms of what they felt they were able and willing to accept as risk in terms of the way they were actually invested. So that was something that we were going to modify. What was important to Lucas and Anna? Protecting their nest egg. They didn't want to go through another 2008 again, because that really impacted them in terms of their personal investments, and also their kids' college funds. Had it not been for 2008, you know, they could have probably covered the room and board. So minimizing taxes, affording college expenses, and of course, reaching their retirement goals. As a result of Lucas's job promotion, his salary was $225,000. Anna's salary as a school psychologist was $90,000. So a good sizable income pushed them in that over $300,000 bracket. They were in the bracket that they would lose itemized deductions, phase out of exemptions, additional Medicare tax, and also the Obamacare taxes. So this really hit them hard. Their budget essentials were $146,000. Discretionary 97, so total budget of 243. A good portion of that was a hefty increase in taxes, and they had a surplus of 72,000. So they were well on their way to basically achieving their retirement goals and also taking care of their kids' college education with the agreed upon proposition they made with their kids. Look, we're going to cover tuition, room and board, outside the state, outside the city. That's yours, because they really wanted to retire and meet their retirement goals, you know, because also they were going to also have a wedding they were going to have to pay for as well. Their retirement budget we looked at, the essential budget was $86,000, discretionary, mainly travel, and especially an RV. Discretionary was around $78,000, total $163,000. When they retired, their Social Security would be $56,000, Anna's pension would be $45,000. They'd have a shortfall of $62,000. Their residence was $620,000. The good news on that, it was mainly paid for. Lucas's retirement assets were $632,000. Anna's was $265,000. And the one thing I always like to see, their personal investments were $225,000, because that always gives us the leeway to sort of plan around income taxes, especially as distributions increase as they get to age 70. So total assets, about $1.7 million. The big thing here was reducing risk in their portfolio. Their risk assessment, they were at a level four risk. Their portfolio was at level seven. Managing competing goals for college and saving for retirement. And that was a compromise that basically we had to reach with their kids and minimizing the taxes. Now, here's something interesting. They wanted to know what would happen if, let's say, the Trump tax plan, a Republican tax plan came through. The net benefit to them as a couple is their income taxes would drop by roughly $6,400 a year, a little over $500 a month in income taxes. And the kid said, hey, could that be used for room and board? But basically, if this Trump plan or Republican plan goes through, their taxes would drop by 6%. But they're still going to be in a high 33% bracket, 9.3% state of California. So they're looking at over 40% income tax bracket. One of the things we did is we used a lot of tax loss harvesting on their mutual funds. They were getting hit every single year, November, December, with what I call the gotcha surprise, the distributions from mutual funds. And of course, we started looking at changing some of that portfolio to dividends that would be taxed at 15% and something that we could hold longer term, reducing the future income taxes. Anna was not making full use of the 403B plan, which allowed her to put $18,000 a year. Eventually, she would be able to put $23,000 a year when she turned age 50. The other thing that they wanted to do is the one thing they emphasized to us is, I do not want to go through another 2007, 2008. And so positioning the portfolio that it would match more of what their personal risk goals are. And then once again, to achieve their college goals for their two children and also the goals for their own retirement was the compromise they reached with their kids. And they said, look, we've got enough money set aside to take care of your tuition for 4 years of college for both of you. But that means staying at home, school nearby. And the reason they said school nearby is the programs that they were looking at for both kids. They had some great private universities here and public universities locally here that they could go to that would be affordable. So, John, overall, there was a compromise between the parents and the kids, a change in the way personal investments were held, and then also maximization of starting to utilize the full benefits of tax deferral for Anna with her 403B plan.
So again, as we always say here on the program, another successful set of plans which work to illustrate what we've been discussing here on the program. Now, tomorrow we have Gary Taubes coming on the program, the case against sugar. And one of the things that I try to do, now I have to admit, I mean, I'm doing my part of the show from Chicago tonight, but when I travel, I start eating a lot of junk food. It's just what you do. When I'm at home, I avoid using a lot of sugar, so much so that when people over sugar things, it doesn't taste right anymore. But there's a real reason for that. Not only does it factor in diabetes, it also factors in other forms of circulatory diseases and things like that.
You know, it was amazing. I read the book, and this will come out in the interview when you listen to it tomorrow. But John, sugar is used in over 600,000 food products. And the book, it was amazing because I was looking at half and half, which we use in coffee in the morning. John, there were several grams of sugar in the coffee creamer. And so you don't think about it. And here's something, folks, that'll blow your mind. In the 19th century, men used to smoke cigars and they smoked pipes. It wasn't until the industrialization of sugar that they were able to cure tobacco leaves that gave rise to cigarettes, because without that sugar cure, you wouldn't be able to inhale cigarettes. So cigarettes, the tobacco industry teamed up with the sugar industry and gave us cigarettes, which we all know are unhealthy. I never knew that, John. I used to smoke. I quit smoking when I was about 38, but I never knew that part of the attraction that enabled you to inhale a cigarette had a lot to do with sugar. So you're going to find this an interesting interview, and it's one of the biggest causes of diabetes in this country.
But let me ask a question, Jim. Now, is he just talking about like the sugar that we're all familiar with, just sucrose? You know, that's what you have on your table. What about bunches of types of sugars, you know, that are present in fruits and fruit juices, natural fruit juices, not even things which have been artificially sweetened, like with corn syrup? Is he just talking about sugar in general?
He's mainly talking about a lot of the artificial sugars, but also you're at risk if you're drinking, you know, a lot of sugary drinks, even though they're natural. Obviously, natural is better. But I mean, if you're drinking orange juice, beet juice, all these things that have a high concentration of sugar. I used to go to the store a lot of times, and I thought I was doing myself a lot of good. John, have you ever seen these kind of natural juices that they have at the health food stores? And you're thinking, gosh, I'm being real healthy
by
drinking those. And then you take a look, 28 grams, 36 grams of sugar. Well, you know, when you get this high afterwards, same thing with the energy drinks, it's caffeine and sugar. So this is probably one of the best books. It really gave a lot of insight in terms of why it used to be 1 out of 8 Americans were obese. Now it's 1 out of 3. The high incidences of that we see of cancer, diabetes, and heart disease in this country. It was a well-researched, well-founded book done by a very award-winning journalist. And you're really going to enjoy this interview.
Oh, the heck with all that. I want the sugar and caffeine buzz.
I know. What would we do without our coffee in the morning?
In reality, I don't use caffeine in the morning. I use an herb drink in the morning, but the sugar is the one that's really the bugaboo, that's really hard to do, because not only is, like you said, artificial sugar, meaning sucrose, is pumped into I don't know how many products, and then you have to ask the question, is that, you know, fructose and other forms of sugar which occur naturally, are they equally as bad, or is it just a matter of controlling, at least controlling the artificial intake? Like, don't sit there and suck down can after can of pop or stuff like that. Some people do.
Yeah, and the real key here is take a look at the content when it says how many grams of carbohydrates, how many grams of protein, how many grams. Look at the grams of sugar, because if you look at the ingredients, they disguise what sugar is in various forms. I mean, we know fructose, sucrose, OSE. If you see OSE in the name, it's probably sugar. But anyway, that is coming up tomorrow here on the program. In the meantime, well, we're out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for tuning into Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.